welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is Wally Rhines. Good morning, Wally.
Good morning, Daniel.
Wally has led fundraising efforts for a fabless semiconductor startup for the last year. I've also been working with emerging companies on fundraising and exit strategies, so this should be an interesting conversation. Wally, let's start with VCs. So venture capital appears to be plentiful right now, and valuations of startup companies for the semiconductor industry are at record levels. Is this a good time to seek VC funding for a new venture?
Well, there's a lot of funding out there, and we're in a phase in the industry where for chip startups, the availability of VC funding hit a peak in the year 2000 at about $2.5 billion and then really has been declining ever since until late 2016, early 2017, when it took off again, hit a new peak of $3.5 billion in 2018, but it's been very solid since then at about $2 billion per year. Now, most of that surge was directed at AI and machine learning, well over half of the total. But there are other areas that are attracting funds as well, like 5G and automotive and a variety of them. So I think the answer is yes, this is a pretty good time to be raising money.
So which funds are most likely to invest in semiconductor startups?
Well, actually, they're fairly unique. A lot of funds don't want to take the risk of the upfront required to get a chip available, but there are some that do, some that even specialize on it. But some just focus on seed rounds, some on what they call Series A, typically $2 to $10 million in a round, and some Series B, $10 to $50 million, and of course, some even post that level. They'll tell you in a conversation if you ask them where they focus, and many of them have specialties relative to businesses. Most of it's available on the website. So when you look up a fund, you can see what they specialize in, whether they're early stage, mid stage, or late stage, and get all that information.
So over the past year, Wally, you've been raising funding for Cornami, which is a chip startup focused on cybersecurity. You're also working with other startups. So what have you learned?
Well, the biggest surprise I got is that I concluded that venture capital investors, they have developed a skill to identify innovative products and services that can be successful in existing markets. They are not typically targeting products and services that will create new markets. And so as a result, in Cornami's case, while we can serve existing markets, the big excitement is creating a whole new market, which over the period of the last year now has become apparent to a lot more people. Fully homomorphic encryption is going to be a big standard for the computer industry, probably eventually permeate most servers in the world. So now it's not such a push to convince people, but early on it was a case of a new market, undefined, how long will it take to develop? And that uncertainty causes venture capitalists to be reticent to move forward.
So what you're saying is VCs are a little bit less interested in new markets, creating new markets. So can you talk a little bit more about that? Why is that?
Well, they raise money for funds, and they have a timetable to invest the money, a timetable to generate returns. If the market you're going after has yet to develop, they have no idea whether it will take years, months, decades. And so it creates a great deal of uncertainty. What I've found is that if you do have an innovative product that is likely to create a new market, your best bet is going with funds that are run by corporations, corporate VC funds, where they have business divisions who are looking out in the future and see that new markets will be important. They're much more open to investing in a market that hasn't yet developed.
Okay. So with Cornami, for example, how are you funding your next round that will take your chip design to full production?
We've worked with a variety of venture capitalists, but we've now come down to a group that's coming together that is largely corporate funds. In a number of cases, we've had to show proof of concept to divisions within the companies so that they would, in fact, support the investment so that the VC organization could make that investment. That requires more time, lots of delays in completing all those proofs of concepts and building the enthusiasm in the division. But ultimately, it's a good kind of investment because you have people who are expert in what you're doing. They see the potential. They're more likely to stay with you over the long term.
Interesting. So, Wally, if you were starting a chip company today, which I know a lot of our audience are, I get a lot of calls on this and I get a lot of pitch decks and such. So if you were doing it today, starting a chip company, how would you go about looking for funding?
Well, I'd start with a very thorough review of the web pages of various candidate VCs, and then I'd just make a list of the ones that appear to fund seed rounds in the kind of application that I'm working in. I'd study the objectives of the funds, and I'd decide what I want out of the fund. Do you want them to actually participate and help you find customers and advise you, or do you want them to be hands-off? Different funds have different objectives. It's best to figure out which partner at the chosen fund is the one you want to work with, because typically they're specialists. And so you try to find one to present your opportunity to who has some expertise in the field or some prior experience with other investments. And it's fairly easy to figure out who invested in what by looking at the web pages and see which companies were the leads and which partners or associates are the ones who focus on that. Before I made my first call, I'd prepare a very clear, succinct slide deck that explains what I was planning to do and why my team is ideal, what the markets will be, what the potential revenue can be, what the time period will be, why my approach is uniquely different, what the competition looks like, things like that, so that you can, in less than 30 minutes, ideally 20 minutes, go through a succinct description and make it very clear and understandable. And then, as I look at different investors who are showing interest, I'd try to find a lead investor who's capable of funding future rounds. Now, this is after the seed round, but as you get into your first round, you want someone taking the lead who can lead follow-on rounds, and also who can attract other investors who will be willing to do multiple rounds as you need them going forward.
Right. And, you know, how does your exit strategy factor into this, Wally? You know, I mean, some companies certainly are going to try and go IPO, but some companies aren't able to. Also, you have SPACs now. I mean, you know, how does the exit strategy play into this all?
Well, I think the exit strategy has become much richer in recent times. So it used to be that it was IPO or acquisition. And so you either targeted yourself to being acquired by certain companies and tried to vector your business in a way that would make yourself attractive, or you decided that you really wanted to take it all the way to IPO and you managed it accordingly. Now there's an intermediate one, the SPAC. Where it is an IPO, but it's a very short-term IPO, and there are lots of SPACs that are creating transactions with companies that don't even have revenue very early in their life cycle. The enthusiasm for SPACs has waned a little recently, but there's enormous money, over $80 billion this year so far. And the thing that works on the side of the entrepreneur is that the SPACs usually have a fixed timetable of about 2 years to invest the money that they have been entrusted with. And if they don't, they end up giving it back to the investors. So they're heavily motivated to find a good acquisition, one where the original investors will be tempted to keep their money in when the conversion is made to equity. The SPAC is in fact a public company. You just switch names with the acquired company and you move on just as if you'd done an IPO, and you have conditions up front for how much money you raise, and they will usually bring in additional funding in what's called a PIPE. And it's a nice mechanism. I hope it continues, but I think it's a little crowded right now. But that gives three stages, the early seed rounds and the VCs, the mid round with a SPAC if you want to go public early, longer term with a SPAC or with an IPO or an acquisition.
Very interesting. So Wally, what about forming a company outside the US, starting with talent from the US? I've heard this come up quite a few times. Is this something that we're going to be seeing more often?
I think we will. There are lots of reasons for that. One, unfortunately, is that people are worried about the ability to sell their products to worldwide markets. The Department of Commerce Export Administration is becoming increasingly aggressive. CFIUS is becoming aggressive. And so you worry when the Chinese are buying over half of the semiconductors in the world, am I going to be restricted from those markets? The answer is yes. If your technology was developed in the U.S., then you probably are going to come under CFIUS review, and that may in fact restrict you. So there are a lot of companies that are setting up operations outside the US, but they still tend to have their headquarters in the US or at least some representation, because the US is a great source of potential customers, and you can work with those customers to define the features of your product, which is then designed in another country, India, or in somewhere in Europe. Sci-Fi was a good example of that. They did a lot of their IP development, actually most of it, outside the U.S., and they set up entities in other countries so that they wouldn't have those restrictions. Most of the companies being started with venture capital in India have a lot of the product definition in the U.S., even though the work of doing the design is largely done in India.
Yeah, Sci-Fi is a good example that they've been very clever how they formed their company. And now I just read something that they might be acquired by Intel for, you know, $2 billion or more dollars. So whatever they've done certainly has worked.
Yeah, I noticed that. That's quite interesting. I think all of the activity in RISC processors, so we have ARM and NVIDIA, we now have Sci-Fi and maybe Intel. We have China standardizing on RISC-V. And then we have all sorts of other new architectures coming to market. The possibility that NVIDIA ends up as a head-to-head competitor with Intel, the activity that AMD is stimulating with its aggressive new products and the use of TSMC processes, the new strategy that Pat Gelsinger is bringing to bear. This is a period of a lot of dynamic change here. And this is something that will benefit from new startups that bring in new architectures, new ideas, new customers, a great period in semiconductor evolution.
I agree completely. And you know, you also have the Googles and the Amazons creating their own domain-specific processors. I can't think of a more exciting, a more competitive time in the semiconductor industry.
Absolutely. In fact, now we're up to 20% of the foundry wafers purchased in the world are bought by systems companies, the Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Alibaba, all those. It was near zero 10 years ago. That's how fast it's changed as they design their own chips. That's been great for the EDA industry. And another element coming on, it appears we're likely to have this $50 billion pouring in the market. Most of it will go into the ability to bring more manufacturing onshore and to big organization R&D, but there'll be some that spills over that creates opportunities for new startups, and I'm sure people will be looking for ways to take advantage of that.
Yeah, and I'm expecting more money after that, of course. So other than chip startups, Wally, what are you involved in, and what have you been doing for the last 2 years since the pandemic, since I last had lunch with you live?
Well, a lot, Daniel. So I continued as CEO Emeritus at Mentor to smooth the transition to Siemens, which has gone very well, I might add. I then wrote two books that you're very much aware of, having worked with me on them. You can buy those on Amazon now. And I'm on advisory boards for three EDA companies and one AI company. And those all have their own issues relative to fundraising. But I think they all are exciting opportunities because they're evolving new kinds of technologies, new businesses. And so I'm learning lots of lessons. I have to say this is probably the most exciting phase of my career.
I have to agree. I think the pandemic has changed the way the world does business, but it certainly has changed the way I do business, and it's a change for the better. So do you have any closing comments, Wally?
Well, yeah, I'd say that venture-funded chip startups are an even more important part of the semiconductor industry future than ever before. Established companies have difficulty innovating out of the box as they become bigger and more bureaucratic. And the financial allure of being an early participant in a startup is increasingly attractive for the really talented engineers and marketeers in the world. Success rates have been much better in recent times, although COVID did make fundraising difficult for a while. And the new emphasis on semiconductors from the federal government, from international trade, for all these things going on, and enormous amounts of money pouring into venture capital in China, where in the U.S., of course, we're paying attention because we've been the hotbed of innovation before. I think the venture-funded startups need to continue their historic record of high level of innovation and building a future. And I think it's going to be very exciting.
Well, I agree. I think now is the time to start a chip company or even an EDA or some type of IP company for exactly what you've said, but also because we have all these systems companies now that are participating in the semiconductor ecosystem. And a systems company exit, you know, being acquired is much more likely now than ever before. So I think we're going to hit some boom times. So I agree with you completely.
So I think it'll be exciting. And you're right. Those systems companies have a lot of money to buy chip startups, and they're doing it. You know, there are a whole set of success cases that have been purchases at very good premiums. We're seeing multi-billion dollar companies that are being bought out by the systems companies, as well as the big semiconductor companies like Intel.
Yeah, and you know, I know you have relationships with Siemens stuff, so you might not be able to say much, but what I can say, I just finished an acquisition with Siemens, you know, Fractal, and I've been involved in several acquisitions with Mentor and a couple now with Siemens, and boy, they really have changed the game. So, you know, if you're an EDA or an IP startup, boy, Siemens is definitely a company you want to talk to. They are being very aggressive. Every other month I'm looking and I'm seeing acquisitions from this company. So it's changing the way acquisitions are done in the EDA business. It seems to be, you know, less reactive and more proactive, very strategic. So I see huge amount of exit opportunities for some of these emerging and even some of these later stage companies. You know, some of the companies that I work with have been around for 10, you know, even 20 years, but you know, now they're looking at exits, and boy, there's just so many opportunities.
Yeah, I think that contrary to intuition, where you'd think that now that the big three of EDA have nearly 90% of the EDA market, that they would be locking out all these startups. But in fact, I think they need them more than ever. And I'm glad to hear that you're seeing that Siemens is continuing the tradition. And I'm sure Cadence and Synopsys are keeping their eyes open for opportunities.
Yeah, I think one of the big reasons is that systems companies are the big customers now, and that's the big growing business for EDA companies. And, you know, some of these system companies want a relationship with one EDA company, whereas, you know, in the history of EDA, we had all these point tools and everybody's trying to get, you know, the ultimate technology flow for designing chips. But now, you know, it seems like the system companies want one company to back them and, you know, want one company to pressure and to deal with. So if you're a big three EDA company, you'd better cover the whole flow, you know. So I think that's what is going on now, is the EDA companies are plugging holes in their flows, or, you know, trying to be more competitive for the system level design.
Well, I've heard that story for the last 30 years, Daniel, and I don't agree. I think there will never be a system company that is able to have to depend solely on a single EDA company. There are critical point tools, as you say, that require you to deal with more than one EDA company. And if you don't deal with more than one EDA company, then you accept an inferior solution in some portion of your design flow. And that's a risk most good companies don't want to take.
Yeah, you're probably right. Okay, well, this is a good time to end. Thank you, Wally, for your time. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we hope to see you again next week.
Thank you, Daniel.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.